Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Lisco.
I am your special guest host, the Mother Superior, Mary St. James.
A perfect opening. With us today, back again, is Stacey Traub to talk with us about Sister Act, the Whoopi Goldberg comedy that as I watched this the other day, it's on Disney Plus for those that don't know. I realized that apparently I'd seen this movie a bunch of times as a kid, and I just it's in my brain basically. Especially the songs, like I was like, oh my god, I vividly remember these songs. But Stacey, when I reached out to you, you gave me a list of movies, and this was one of them. And I'm curious as to what your history is with Sister Act.
My history is that I'd never seen it. I swear to God.
You picked it because it, okay.
No, I picked it because I know it's iconic and people reference it, and I have friends.
Sure.
Specifically some of my, you know, gay male friends who it is their favorite movie of all time. And I texted my friend last night after I watched it, and he's like, immediately watch the next one. Don't even press pause. Go to the next one, you know, and then it got late. So I didn't get to watch the whole next one. But yeah, so I was
people do think the second one is, there's a lot of people that tweeted at me and was like, the second was better than the first, which.
Okay. Well,
that's a choice. I mean, I don't know. That
And I see, you know, it was pretty delightful. My one big takeaway I had was that I believe that Natasha Lyonne based her poker face character on Whoopi in this movie. There are a lot of similarities.
There are actually, yeah, I guess I just didn't even really think about that. I mean, the concept in and of itself of her hiding from criminals within a job that seems ill-fitting.
And just her, like, you know, sassy, I don't give a shit attitude. And,
yes.
You know, her lack of fear.
Also true. So Emily, you had seen Sister Act, correct?
Well, Phil, I saw Sister Act in the year 1992 in movie theaters.
We did it, guys.
The other movie I saw in theaters, that Aladdin and Sister Act. It was like 5-6 weeks into the run, and it was still playing. at the Roxy Cinema 5, might have been Cinema 3 at that time, in Mitchell, South Dakota, because it was such a hit and the people loved it. And we went and after church and we went and saw it and we all had a good time. My mom, who grew up Catholic and then converted to evangelical Christianity, really loved it. Mm. And, you know, the only note anybody in our family had was that it was too bad that at the end of the movie, Whoopi didn't get saved. So,
oh wow! I mean, I would argue she is saved.
Yeah. She's definitely she's like person. She's changed by the experience. Yes. She definitely like has a closer relationship to some sort of divine. But she didn't do the thing where she kneeled down and asked Jesus to come into her heart, which is the end of every Christian movie. And Sister Act's box office would have fallen dramatically if she had done that. Yeah. But at the time, we were like, everybody's just like us. So therefore, this movie would have been the biggest movie of all time if she had just, yeah.
I do love that we have recorded, Emily, for 1992. I think we've recorded in the vicinity of around 40 episodes.
Sounds right.
And that we've finally stumbled on the only other film you had seen from 1992 at the time.
In theaters. I mean, I did see some on video, but like later. And like I watched, so I'm team Sister Act 2 is better than Sister Act 1.
Yeah.
I watched that on pay-per-view. I never saw that in theaters. I'm surprised they haven't forced Whoopi to do Sister Act 3.
Well, she's talked about doing it. I mean, I don't think she's against it. I think she's the feeling. First of all, she was in the musical on Broadway. Do you know anything about the musical, Emily?
I didn't take the time to listen to it.
Nor should you. I just
like I did with Honeymoon in Vegas. the team behind Sister Act, I mean, it's like Alan Menken and stuff, but like I've never been as like the fact that Honeymoon in Vegas was Jason Robert Brown was why I, but yeah, Sister Act, I was like, it's fine. Whatever.
What's interesting is Whoopi is in the musical playing the Maggie Smith role, if I'm not mistaken. She did a handful of performances. She did not sort of do the run of it. And she is, the people have asked her about doing a Sister Act 3. She certainly doesn't seem opposed to it. I think that either a good script hasn't come her way, or she doesn't really act that much these days. So she's probably like, I don't know that she's all that, you know.
It's interesting that the Whoopi role in the musical was originated by Patina Miller, who's like one of the great stage performers of her generation. But it's like before she becomes Patina Miller. So I wonder if that was part of her like rise to her current self.
Also interesting that like, so what I found interesting about this film for me personally is that like the first 45 minutes of it, I'd be lying if I felt I was really engaged. The movie comes to life once she takes over the choir.
Yes. This was, I always please. Write down when major shit is happening. Mm-hmm. And so like at minute 15, she sees the killing.
Yes.
And at minute 30, she's shown her cell to live in.
Yep.
And it isn't until, like you're saying, like minute 45 that I'm like, shouldn't this have happened at minute 15 or 30? Well,
at the very least, or 30. Yeah. I think it takes a little too long. I think it's enjoying the fish out of waterness of it, right? Of like, we've got Whoopi and she's wearing a habit and like, you know, she's surrounded by nuns. Like, there's jokes here, but I think that ultimately they could have had their cake and eat it too, right? Like they could have had that fish out of water stuff and had those jokes and also pulled her into the choir a little bit faster. Because once that happens and the movie ultimately becomes, I guess I never realized how much School of Rock is indebted to Sister Act in the sense of like once conceptually we are in that mode, that's when I'm locked into the movie and that's when it really starts working for me. So I think it's interesting. And the second one has very little music in it. Like it's mostly, it doesn't have nearly as much music as I feel like this one has.
It has. I mean, the thing about the second one is the last like 30 minutes is like straight musical performance. Like they're in the competition. It's an episode of Glee, you know, without the like musical numbers scattered throughout. And like, and the thing is, like, the reason to watch these movies is the musical performances. And the ones in the second movie are better because they've got, like, Lauryn Hill. They've got Lauryn Hill,
yeah.
And I mean, everything I remembered about this movie from seeing it in theaters in 1992, a thing that I did, was from the last like 45 minutes.
Yes.
And I do think one thing that's interesting that maybe is hindering Sister Act 3 getting made is Catholicism doesn't, it has a, like, it's weird. It has a larger footprint now, but people aren't as familiar with it. Like jokes about nuns in 92 could like kill in a way they kind of can't now.
Yeah.
But because like we have a very different cultural context for Christianity, especially, but also Catholicism in particular, now that it's become this like, you know, it's a force of that's pushing back against some things that I think personally are great. So
it's interesting you bring that up, because as I was watching it, I was thinking about the two, I guess, most recent Damon Lindelof projects, the first being Watchmen and the second being Mrs. Davis, which both have nuns as primary characters, and sort of this unpacking or sort of this. The way that he's using that imagery speaks to what you're talking about, Emily, of like, well, that, you know, it doesn't have the same, it's just powerful in a different way now.
The thing about Catholicism is it has an iconography that you can just like go to like that. Like probably like I've met like two nuns in my life and they were not wearing the habits, yeah. But I see the habit. I don't think I've maybe seen that once or twice in the wild in like an airport, but like, you see that habit and you're like, oh, that's a nun. And like, you just have all these things that yes. come to mind in a way that like even a person wearing a priest collar doesn't like trigger for you.
Yeah.
Well, also, you know, I just want to add, like, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, there's been some shit going on and it doesn't, I'm not saying it's canceled, but
it's you close. Know,
it is, it's clearly fallible. So it doesn't, they're like this reverence, like even at the end of the movie where like they're not going to shoot a nun, you know, again, I think that would kind of still work today, but it's a little bit, it's certainly tainted.
Yeah.
Well, it's also like the scene where they're performing this incredibly kind of anodyne musical number and a bunch of like street punks come in and are like, we're going to go to church.
Yes.
Is a thing you can't do anymore. You know, we live in a world now where the vast majority of churches are failing, especially mainline Protestant. But like, there's a lot of these smaller Catholic parishes, like the one we see in this movie, that just don't do as well anymore. You know, even the evangelical mega churches that were so big 10 years ago are starting to lose membership. The Christianity in general, and like I'm a Christian, I go to church, but like I go to a very progressive denomination, my pastor's a lesbian, all of these things. Like the Christianity in general has been really harmed by the fact that its worst adherents are like the worst people on the planet. So right. it's I think that there's just a thing around, you can't do a movie like this anymore without turning off half the audience, and you can't do it in a way that would appease the other half, because you'd have to do the scene where Whoopi like witnesses to someone about the power of Christ, and like it just is a no-win proposition. But they should still make Sister Act 3. It should just be a deconstruction of why Christianity is bad.
You know, it is interesting too, because I just recently rewatched season 2 of Fleabag for a Patreon episode, and that's another depiction of, you know, you mentioned the priest thing, right? And how what sort of initial reaction you would have to that, and the deconstruction of that within Fleabag as well, of, you know, the whole hot priest meme, the whole sort of I would argue that Christianity is almost, you know, a side issue in that show, right? Like I don't think that Phoebe Waller-Bridge within the context of that show is saying all that much about Christianity. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, Emily. You do have a poster for the show behind you, so I'm assuming you have thoughts.
I don't think it's saying anything about Christianity, but I think it's saying something about
faith.
I think there is a thing that we have lost now that religious organizations are decentralized in basically all of the European sphere, and, you know, basically any country that is like above a certain economic level, like now religion is either decentralized or it's become, or if it's centralized, it's like this horrifying force that's dragging people back toward some whatever. But I do think that there is this thing. The reason I still go to church, I can't believe we're talking about this.
Well, I mean, you had to imagine it's
Sister Act. Yeah. But the reason I still go to church is this is after church. I'm not sure I believe in any of it, but after church, like all these people get together and have coffee. It's the one place I still come into contact with. Like the thing I always talk about is like, there's a lot of people who go there who are in their 80s. I don't normally hang out with people in their 80s, but like, that's a place that I talk to them and get to know them and like hear their stories.
Right.
I think that when we got rid of those sorts of social organizations at the center of our communities, we created a situation where people kind of only talk to people exactly like them, which created these bubbles, which created a sense of, and this honestly, this has happened within the church too. Evangelical megachurches are spaces to propagate, you know, a white supremacist patriarchal agenda, because that's the people who are there. It's all sort of sorted out and filtered out. So the thing that you see in Sister Act, which is this hub of the community that everybody kind of knows about and can pour into and is just starting to have financial trouble, like 30 years later, it's gone, you know? And well, I think we've lost that. I don't know if like, I think that getting rid of like Christianity as the center of our society is a good thing, but we did lose that social cohesion that I think we haven't quite figured out how to get back.
I do think, you know, there's a montage in the middle of this film that I really kind of loved, and maybe just because of how sort of idealistic and sort of a fantasy, quite frankly, it is. But like them cleaning up the church and taking a car that was sort of, you know, and turning it into a jungle gym for kids and like, you know, helping the community, and it gets on television and this, that, and whatever. It's a lovely notion, and it does feel like, to your point, Emily, it's sort of propagating the notion of what church and community could have been back in 1992 in terms of what they were hoping it could be for your community. Mm-hmm. But if you had that sequence today in a movie, people would be like, are you out of your fucking mind? Like, do you think that that's so? Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. I think that there is something lovely about that sequence, and yet at the same time, it does feel kind of woefully naive.
Like one thing that my church did in the, when vaccinations were just starting to happen, is they got a bunch of vaccines and they provided them to people in the community with a heavy emphasis on unhoused people and people who were trans. And like, I helped sort of with that drive. If you put that in a movie, people would assume either A, you were lying, or B, that you were like trying to whitewash Christianity in some way. And like, I don't know. I struggle with this a lot, because I'm like, you know, what, that was a good thing. It did a lot of good in the world. And yet me talking about it sort of sounds like I'm trying to excuse all the bad stuff people I don't even know who like live in fucking Alabama are doing, you know?
Well, I think the movie, like, I think Sister Act is,
this is a podcast about Sister Act.
It is
by
a
the way.
Podcast about Sister Act. And I do think, but I ultimately think that, you know, one of the reasons that this movie works is that I think there's a fair amount of thought being put into the script. Mm-hmm. Like I learned something that I didn't know, which is that this movie was essentially Paul Rudnick wrote a script. Paul Rudnick of Addams Family Values, In and Out, a phenomenal comedic screenwriter, writes this script with, I guess, Bette Midler was originally the person that was attached to the role. And ultimately she doesn't do it because she feared that her fans would not want to see her play a nun, whatever that means.
Her Jewish fans
might not want to see her play a nun. Scott Rudin is producing it. It's 87. Yes. Bad news. Don't like it.
It was not a name I was excited to see.
Yes. Unfortunately, but he produces this, he's working with Paul Rudnick in 87 to make this movie with Bette Midler. It's brought to Disney. Eventually Whoopi Goldberg signs on, and then there's a half a dozen screenwriters that are brought in to do passes on this script. Carrie Fisher, Nancy Myers being two significant names. And you do get the impression that like there's a thoughtfulness to this script that I was surprised by, right? Cause like there's an obvious kind of Whoopi's a nun, right? Like that, I get the jokes, right? Like it's all there for the taking. And yet there is sort of these subtle character arcs and conflicts that I appreciated about it. I think like the Maggie Smith character and her feeling outmoded, mm-hmm. You know, all these things there that I was like, this movie's a lot richer than I kind of expected, and a lot kind of big hearted. And like Whoopi is such a, like, she just feels like a big hearted, always her performances are just larger than life. And she's such a loving personality. She's mm-hmm. so watchable in that way that the movie is just kind of bursting with all of that. And it's funny because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the first 45 minutes, I'm like, this movie made $300 million. Like, why did this movie do so well? And then the back half, I'm just like, oh, this thing is just, once it's on rails and once it's like really in the pocket, it's kind of, I absolutely understand why it works and why people loved it as much as they did.
I think, I think $300 million is literally just the poster. Like, you right? see, this is the height of Whoopi, and you see her in The Nun Habit. It's like the height of Whoopi and like the declining power of nuns, but like the two together.
A force worth reckoning with. Yeah, it's, you know, it's so funny because I don't think I saw this in theaters. Maybe I did. I don't remember. But, you know, first of all, let me give just a little bit of context so that people who have not seen Sister Act, when lively lounge singer Dolores Van Cartier, played by Whoopi Goldberg, sees her mobster beau, Vince the Rocket, played by Harvey Keitel, commit murder, she is relocated for her protection. Set up in the guise of a nun in a California convent, Dolores proceeds to upend the quiet lives of the resident sisters. In an effort to keep her out of trouble, they assign Dolores to the covens. Convents, that is, choir, an ensemble that she soon turns into a vibrant and soulful act that gains widespread attention. Sister Act opened on May 29th, 1992, against Lethal Weapon 3, Alien 3, Far and Away, Encino Man, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $231 million on a $31 million budget. It's got 75% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 65% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 2.5 stars and said, the first time I saw the film's coming attractions for Sister Act, I roared with laughter and delight. The second time, I laughed again. Even the third time, I smiled. It's one of the great trailers. Unfortunately, it's better directed than the movie. The trailer has high energy and whammo punchlines. The movie is sort of low-key and contemplative and a little too thoughtful. He then goes on to talk about how he doesn't think the director was well-suited for the material, which I guess it's kind of conventionally directed, but, you know, that's sort of what to expect from a touchstone comedy back in 1992. I mean, I think they knew they had Whoopi and they just kind of pointed the camera at her, but I thought it was
surprisingly good. I mean, I was really, minus the length, like the time it took before she started the choir. Mm-hmm. Like, it's funny because Ebert's saying, he's saying thoughtful as a negative.
Yeah, I know.
You know? And I'm like, I think those are the comedies that actually withstand the test. You know, like, I can watch Tootsie today and still love it. You know, I don't know that it's aged. And maybe it's also because, you know, nuns are obviously like an archetype that come with certain, you know, like, that hasn't, you know, nuns have not changed in a bit, you know, nuns are nuns kind of thing.
Nuns are nuns.
So, you know, you're putting her in a situation that, I just think it translated really nicely. And I think you don't quite need the scene where they go to like the nearby biker bar, but I do love the line at the end. Where the guy
becomes a nun's bar, I'm out of here.
Yeah, if this becomes a nun's bar, I'm out of here. Like, that was great. And they ended the scene on a joke. Like, I don't know. I thought there's so many movies from then. I mean, Honeymoon in Vegas being one, where you're watching it and cringing a little bit at the comedy. And I mean, yeah, like Whoopi Goldberg, it's going to be fish out of water. If she's gonna do a joke, an inappropriate joke about sex, or even mention the word sex, you're gonna get a laugh because she can't, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think
I do. This kind of makes me wonder about. I want to talk about Whoopi for a second because I do think that Whoopi is kind of the secret sauce to this, because I do think that there is something kind of timeless about Whoopi Goldberg. And I say that in the best possible way. Like, I really do feel as though, for the most part, a lot of her films, or certainly her bigger films, have aged quite well, because I feel as though she feels like the tip of the spear in a lot of ways. Like, I do think that the fact that, and that there is a Black woman in this lead role in this way, I think also opens the film up in so many interesting and wonderful ways too, because I think that Whoopi kind of broke through in so many ways in terms of just race and who was open to her. And it felt like she just kind of has this lovely quality to her.
Can I just add one thing? I was thinking when I was watching, is that I was like, do we have that person today? And then I kind of thought, like, Tiffany Haddish kind of has that quality where, you know, she can do a voice in the Lego movie. You know, she was Queen Wanamadarana, whatever.
Sure.
You know what I mean? She just.
And then she could do After Party, and she, I mean,
she's just very likable, and she's her own thing. Like, I don't think anyone else is quite doing what Tiffany Haddish does. And I don't think anyone was doing what Whoopi was doing. She was Whoopi. Like,
yeah,
her persona is bigger than the character.
And there's a groundedness to, like, part of Tiffany's thing is her backstory, right? Like,
yes,
her life and what, you know, that has obviously brought to her career. And I think with Whoopi, I mean, I think that a lot of people forget that her first role is basically The Color Purple.
Mm.
Like, that is the thing that everyone sort of, that's what gets her, obviously, notoriety, which is slightly ironic because she's a stand-up comic, you know what I mean? And she's doing this role that is obviously filled with trauma. And, I mean, listen, we could talk about The Color Purple for hours. There's a whole lot to unpack there. But that's sort of the first thing she does. And then she immediately does Jumping Jack Flash, which is a big hit. You know, at this point in 92, she's coming off of an Academy Award winning performance in Ghost, a movie that I love, even though it's completely bonkers. And what are your thoughts on Ghost, Emily? You like Ghost?
It's fine. I haven't seen that since probably it came out, you know.
You know when you're going to have to rewatch Ghost, Emily, when we do our screen draft on Ghosts at the end of this year.
Everyone keeps telling me I'm doing this, and I've yet to formally commit to it. I know that because you're all telling me I'm doing it, I will end up doing it, because
I mean, you did, but whatever. That's neither here nor there. If and when you decide to do this Ghost screen draft, you're gonna.
It's weird. I would not have thought of that as a movie about ghosts, despite the title. Literally, I'm just like, ghost movies are scary, and Ghost is not particularly scary. Like, and so I would not have thought of Ghost as a movie about ghosts. Like, that is literally true. I would not have watched that for this screen drafts that
you may end up doing. Yeah. But it's, you've got Ghost, which is obviously this gigantic hit. I mean, just a shockingly successful film. And then it's Soap Dish that she has a bit role in, which is a movie that I kind of like, but I have not watched since I was a kid, so I don't know how well it holds up. Then you've got Sister Act. She's also in The Player. She has a supporting role in The Player. We'll talk about that at some point.
So
just a wonderful movie, and she's great in it. Then we've got the whole Made in America fiasco with Ted Danson, which, you know, was a whole thing that happens in 93 when he thought it was a good idea to go blackface to something. A moment in Ted Danson's career that we don't talk about nearly enough. But somehow, they're dating, weirdly. That's a weird couple, but they're dating for a while. And she does Sister Act 2, also in 93. And then, like, she's got a million things. She's a voice in The Lion King. She's in Star Trek Generation. She's in Karina, Boys on the Side. I mean, her career is crazy. She's doing, if you look at her filmography, she's doing anywhere from 3 to 6 movies a year.
Is incredible for a woman who will not get on an airplane.
Oh, she won't? She won't fly?
She will not fly. Because we tried to have her.
Oh, wow.
Some show I was on. We were going to have her as guest star, and we were going to have to get her a bus from New York to come out. Did we end up doing it? That's, I can't remember. Crazy. She won't get on an airplane.
She's I love her. I think she's great. I think she's just got a tremendous career. And now she's on The View, and I'm sure she's doing very well for herself.
I think that we got to return to Ted Danson. And Whoopi
please,
Goldberg.
Please go for it.
How can we not?
I didn't mean to breeze past that.
I remember he was one of the guys in Hollywood who was he's been with his wife forever. Mm-hmm. And I just looked that up, and he ended that marriage so he could be with Whoopi Goldberg. They were together for a year, maybe 18 months. Mm-hmm. Then the Friars Club thing just is, you know, such a terrible decision on everybody's part. And then they break up, and then he gets together with Mary Steenburgen, and everyone forgets he hasn't been with her since the dawn of time, because they've been together since 95, which is, again, almost 30 years
almost
ago.
The dawn of time.
So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting because the Friars Club thing comes up in we did Kenny and I for 99 covered the documentary Get Bruce about Bruce Valanche. And there's a moment in there because Bruce was involved in that fiasco, because Bruce and Whoopi and Ted sat down and thought of this bit and thought that this was going to be funny for him to show up in blackface to the Friars Club. And Whoopi in the documentary eats crow and is this is a bad idea. We should never have done this. I don't know why we thought this was a good idea. I felt genuinely bad for Ted. I imagine it was probably one of the reasons that their relationship fell apart, just in terms of in the public eye, that they couldn't be together anymore or whatever. The whole thing was just, it's also just a weird couple to begin with. These are two people that I don't necessarily associate together. More power to them. I'm glad that they found love for as brief as it was, but it is just a fascinating moment in time. And all the people involved are all just it was a bad idea. We should never have done it. But I want to talk for a second about, so you mentioned this earlier, Emily, that Whoopi's at sort of the peak of her powers as Sister Act is coming out. And Whoopi hires Carrie Fisher to rewrite her dialogue. And it led to many sort of arguments with Disney. And apparently Carrie Fisher told Whoopi Goldberg, "You're getting into a pissing contest with people who have actual dicks." And I do think that there's something interesting about Whoopi using her clout, you know what I mean? Really sort of digging her heels in. And again, it really should be said, this is a black woman in 1992 who is really sort of using her clout and using her power, as she should, to make sure that this role is as good as it could be. And I think that that's amazing.
Yeah, she's I think that she's an electric performer. I was just double checking this, but she broke through because Mike Nichols saw her one woman show off Broadway and was "You are great. I'm gonna make you a star." Brings her to Broadway, and she becomes huge off that. Spielberg sees that as "I'm going to put you in Color Purple." There was something really undeniable about her, but she there is a thing about her that I think, if you've ever seen that one woman show, which was recorded and put on HBO, there's something really electric about her as a stage performer. And that's one reason I think she's really succeeded on The View, is there's this connection she forms with people in a live situation that translates a bit in film, translates especially in her best movies. But I think there is something about her that is she would have been so well suited to just, doing an endless string of Broadway shows.
I also feel obviously Spielberg is incredibly well at discovering people. He's done it many, many times in his career, and I'm sure will continue to do so. She is luminescent in The Color Purple. Say what you will about The Color Purple, but she lights up the screen. And
you remind me what year is the Color Purple?
85.
Is 85.
Okay.
And she just, Spielberg understands that audiences love to discover someone, right? To see someone for the first time. And when you see her in that movie, he is weaponizing that freshness and that excitement and that discovery of someone unseen before. But I agree with you, Emily. She is, she's just incredibly watchable. There is something so, effortless about it too. It doesn't feel The View's a perfect example of that, Emily, of just sort of this, that she's an energy resource, right? Like, this is just, she gives this off effortlessly. And she's really lovely in this movie and funny in this movie. I do wonder about, like, if there was supposed to be a romance between her and the cop that they cut, because I feel like there might have
been. Yeah, I was just thinking, like, she is all those things, but there's kind of a lack of sexuality to her, which I think is interesting. Like, I think that's part of the, it's weird that she's dating Ted Danson, because you almost are like, I'm not sure who I would imagine her dating. Like, she kind of
butthurt Harvey Keitel. Is that weird?
Yeah, but you never saw them like touch each other. Yeah. You never see her kiss. Like, and now when I'm thinking of my Tiffany Haddish thing, Tiffany Haddish is treated similarly. I don't know that I've seen her in like a romantic.
The Card Counter? I haven't seen it, but I think maybe her and Oscar Isaac have romance in that movie, but I haven't seen it.
Maybe.
But your point.
Whoopi kind of like is almost above it, you know?
Yeah. She is like, Made in America is a rom-com, like a pretty classic rom-com. I didn't know Will Smith was in that movie. I just discovered that. He's like her best friend. Like, that's when Will Smith was just like, he was playing the best friend part. He's the fast talking guy who helps her con her way into like figuring out that her sperm donor was Ted Danson. So
isn't also, I mean, Jumping Jack Flash is also kind of a romance. It's all off screen in the sense that like he's in the computer and then at the end she meets him and I believe they kiss at the end of that film.
Famously, we love when a romance is all off screen. Actually, I kind of do. That was a joke. And then I was like, actually, that's kind of good when that happens.
Sometimes it works.
I also think it's the time, because I also really noted that you do not see the murder that she witnesses at the beginning. You see the gun to the guy's head. You see a little blood on his cheek. But she walks in and it's all played off her expression. They never cut to even the dead body. And I was like, that's really, and I don't know if that's more about the time, about the rating that they wanted,
Disney,
or about the fact that it's a comedy and it's just kind of a line that you won't cross. But I found that interesting. And I was like, I feel like today you'd see it.
Oh, you'd absolutely see it today.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is I'm trying to think of like, quote unquote, the most sexual Whoopi Goldberg performances. And like The Color Purple is kind of up there in terms of that her relationship with, forgive me, I can't remember the character's name, in The Color Purple, which is a same sex relationship, is beautiful. And I certainly bought that. I do wonder if this is also perhaps part of Whoopi's thing, which is that she's just like, maybe A, she doesn't think that's what people want from her, and B, maybe she doesn't want to give it to them, right? Like, she's just like, I'd prefer to keep this
you know,
for jokes and whatever. I don't know. It's interesting to think about, because I do think this movie seems to be like tiptoeing there. Like, that cop seems to be into her, and there does seem to be something going on there.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was cut. If there were scenes written or whatever, but like, there's an energy there. I also
famously, once you're a nun, you take a vow of chastity. So even when she's undercover in witness protection,
Yeah. No, that's fair. Something I learned that I love is that Pedro Almodovar turned down the offer to direct this film.
Oh my God. What would that be?
Oh my God.
That would be wild.
I would love to see that movie. How wild would that movie be?
That'd be good. Would be one of the best movies ever made. He should do just a random American studio programmer. Almodovar,
Three? Come on.
Yeah. Here's the reason. This is the new reason I don't think there's a Sister Act 3, is they can't get Pedro. But like,
he's the holdout.
Have you seen Going My Way / The Bells of St. Mary's?
I've not.
There are these movies from the 40s, came out 2 years in a row. Sister Act and Sister Act 2 are kind of remakes of both of them.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, like, they have very similar plot structures. You know, Going My Way is about like a hip young priest who sings and comes to this parish, and the older priest is like, I don't like your ways and your modern music. And then it won Best Picture. It won like 70 Oscars. Oh, okay. People loved it.
Wow.
And then The Bells of St. Mary's is even better. It's I'm a Sister Act 2 Bells of St. Mary's kind of gal. And that's like, we have a struggling school in our community. Let's save it with music. So I think that the fact that there was never a third movie in that trilogy means that they cannot complete the Sister Act trilogy.
They don't know what to do.
But Pedro could come in and be like, what if this was like a weird, like sexual, like journey? And, you know, and we learned a lot about our mothers. That'd be great.
Yes, that'd be, I would. I mean, if Sister Act 3 was about Whoopi's not knowing she had a child or finding her long lost child or something along those lines.
Actually, Sister Act 3. Okay, we got it. So Whoopi has a daughter and the daughter's like, I am in trouble with the law. What do I do? And Whoopi's like, you got to be a nun. And,
yeah.
Then there's like a poignant mother-daughter relationship, yep. And it's about the problems on both sides. Almodovar, let's do this.
Oh my God, what I would give. I do think, I mean, the idea that he was even approached. In 1992, Almodovar is still in his early days of his career. Like, this isn't, I mean, this, what, like Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown feels like?
Yeah. Oh, wait, yeah, so, I just thought of what it is. Sister Act 3 is...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Two nuns have to go into hiding as strippers. You fucking flip it. You make very chaste women or a woman have to be very bawdy.
I mean, Maggie Smith is still with us, right? I mean, there's nothing stopping.
What if Maggie Smith was a stripper? That's
yes,
plot.
We've got it. No, yeah. I was thinking that too. I was like, God, Maggie Smith has been old forever.
I thought that too. I was like, has she been this age for 50 years?
No, because my 9-year-old walked in when I was watching and she's like, oh, that's the lady from Harry Potter. And I was like, oh. But wasn't she also on Downton Abbey?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She won so many Emmys for that. She was go ahead.
No. I was gonna say she has to be like in her 90s then.
She is. That's a very good question.
I feel like she's one of those people who started looking old at like 45. Mm-hmm. Like Max von Sydow. Okay.
88. Yeah. Yeah. Well, she is because she was also, she had a whole career as a young woman, right? Mm-hmm. Like there just seemed to be like a gap that happened.
She was like a babe. And then she was old. There was like just like babe.
One to the other. This is like
prime of Miss Jean Brody is 69,
mm-hmm.
and she's, you know, she's young and beautiful in that. And then it's like there's like a 10-year gap until California Suite in 78, and then she's just old. Like
what I love about her as a woman, as seeing her as an aspirational figure, is she got to this point where she looked like she was 70 and she's probably in her early 50s and her career got better. Everyone was like, we want more of this. We want you to do everything.
Yeah. Like Angela Lansbury.
Yeah.
Yes. God rest her soul. But God rest her soul. You know, she looked old from day one.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I don't know enough about Maggie Smith's earlier career. I should, but I don't. But it does feel as though I think the first time I probably remember seeing her is Hook when she plays old Wendy.
Mm-hmm.
So she's just always kind of old in my brain.
It's very weird you don't know much about Maggie Smith's early career when this is a Maggie Smith podcast. You'd think you would have checked in on that.
It is weird. So
the
I want to
talk about Maggie Smith.
Harvey Keitel, who is in two films in 1992, Sister Act and Bad Lieutenant, just to show the breadth of Harvey Keitel's
another
career.
Church movie.
Another Catholic Church.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that has nuns as well. Have you seen Bad Lieutenant, Emily?
I don't think I have. I think I saw the other one. I think I saw the Bad Lieutenant
Port of. Yeah.
Here's the thing. In 1992, I am in undergrad film school. And I saw The Bad Lieutenant in a theater, did not see Sister Act, because I was a snob. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm not going to go see Sister Act. I'm going to go see this edgy, you know.
Listen,
Bad Lieutenant's a weird movie, but I'm excited to rewatch it.
We walked up to the Roxy Cinema 3 and we were like, is it Sister Act or is it Bad Lieutenant? It's after church. Gotta make a choice here. Yeah.
Oh, so there were... Unbeknownst to me, I learned this as I was doing some research for this film. There were two controversies with this film and lawsuits with this film that I was unaware of. The first was that an actress sued Disney, Whoopi Goldberg, Bette Midler, the production companies, and CAA, a $200 million lawsuit in 93, claiming that they plagiarized her book, A Nun in the Closet. Ultimately, she argued that the script had been... whatever. Long story short, the lawsuit was overturned and she wasn't paid. Then there was another lawsuit in 2011. A nun named Dolores Blakely filed a lawsuit against Disney and Sony claiming that the Harlem Street Nun, an autobiography she wrote in 87, was the basis for the film. She alleged that the movie executive expressed interest in the movie rights after she wrote a 3-page synopsis and believed that she was owed money. She drops the lawsuit in 2012 to serve a more robust lawsuit in 2012, asking for, wait for it, $1 billion. She was not awarded any damages, but so rare that someone asks for $1 billion in a lawsuit, but God bless her for trying.
Yeah.
But then the New York Supreme Court dismissed the lawsuit, but I mean, it went to the Supreme Court of New York. That's not nothing, but yeah. So, you know, a little history lesson on Sister Act. The movie opens with this in 68, Dolores is a young girl in a Catholic school. She doesn't take her studies seriously. She embarrasses the nun teachers, what have you. And then we have this match cut to her singing in Reno, Nevada, which is great.
With Cheryl Lee Ralph, by the way, did you notice that?
Yes.
She's one of the singers.
Amazing. She has a bigger part in movie two.
She plays the mom to Lauryn Hill, right?
Oh.
She Lauryn Hill's mom in the second one? I believe she is. It is interesting that we have this backstory and then it's kind of never touched on again.
Yeah.
Which I kind of liked in a weird way. Because it kind of gave us, I'm not saying that they couldn't have underlined it more, they probably could have, but just knowing that she has this past and bringing that baggage to her being forced to live in this convent, I thought was an interesting choice. But what did you guys think of it?
I mean, sorry. You want to go first?
No, go ahead, Stacey.
Okay. Having not seen it, you know, I was like, oh, this is an interesting way to start the movie. And I thought the girl was good. Like she had like a whoopee
energy. Yeah.
Yes. A smile, a smirk that, you know, I was buying. And I do think it adds a weight. It adds a guilt, you know, for Whoopi who did not fit in that world and clearly rejected it to have to be dragged back into it. I think it does add an extra layer that had she never dealt with religion or been a non-religious person altogether, there wouldn't be a reverence for it. She wouldn't care as much. So I thought it was kind of a really smart thing. And then just to admit something beyond idiotic. So then when my friend said, watch the next one, I was talking to my daughter, whatever. And then I clicked on Sister Act 2, but I clicked on Sister Act 1 again. And I start texting my friend. I'm like, it starts the exact same way. He goes, yeah, it gets better. Cause he meant there's that big musical number.
Incredible.
And I went all, I got all the way to, you know, them singing in Reno. And then I paused. I'm like, oh, I'm watching. Yeah. I'm watching it again.
Well, like, like Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, the sister act duology continually revisits scenes from different perspectives to provide more information and knowledge. Right. Yeah.
I guess what I liked about the opening is it's a little tropey. So I appreciate that, like, that they kind of don't go back to the well later in the movie, right? That we don't have some speech of her being like, you know, some expositional scene with one of the nuns or whatever about how hard it was being at that Catholic school as a kid or whatever the case might be. I like that it was just sort of a little bit of a basis for where we're going and where her character's heading. I mentioned this earlier, but there's something about Harvey Keitel and Whoopi Goldberg's energy as a couple that I was just sort of like, I'm kind of into this, and I don't know how to explain it. I think it's more what I'm bringing to the scene in terms of like my knowledge of their filmographies and all of that, that just kind of made me go like, I'd watch a movie where Harvey Keitel and Whoopi Goldberg were dating. Like, I think that's interesting. Did you buy them?
Let's do a show where they're like a couple. Let's just do a show where they've been married for like 40 years. They have like three kids.
Great. Yeah.
And the kids all have to move back in because the economy, something like that.
I mean, if Scenes from a Marriage was them.
Yes.
Wow.
Would have been interesting.
Yeah. I just want more Whoopi and I want more Harvey. I guess. Harvey Keitel, to be specific.
Yes. Yes. You're going to get to see lots of Harvey when we watch Bad Lieutenant, let me tell you.
Hell yeah.
Every part of him, really.
Every part of him.
That is one thing I love about him is he will do a fucking movie like this. Yeah. And then he'll do a thing where he just has his dick out.
The piano. Just,
yeah.
He's just like, and he is like, I want to work with people I think are interesting. And that could be Whoopi Goldberg. That could be Jane Campion. You know,
I want to work with people that will let me show my dick.
I had a crush on him when he was in the piano, for sure.
He is hot in that movie in a weird way.
It was the idea of him.
Yes.
That's kind of
that movie's amazing. But he, Harvey Keitel is. And then, I mean, oh my God, why can't I think of the Kate Winslet movie that he does with Jane Campion?
Holy smoke,
right, where he's deprogramming her but really she's programming him. I don't know,
it's
a weird movie. I think that part of this first 45 minutes that certainly could have been cut down was this, like, she's his mistress and he gives her a coat that's his wife's, and it's like, you know what I mean, like their relationship stuff and the messiness of this sort of adulterous relationship that they have, it's fine, but I don't need it. Like, we could have got there faster.
Yeah, but you know,
this movie's like an hour
45
when it could be an hour and a half.
The thing is it's that thing about, like, once we got there, and again, because I hadn't seen it, when they're singing My Guy, but they're singing My God,
My God,
I literally wrote down, this is amazing. Like, I was like, this was a great idea. And I did think, like, I remember Hunter walked through and said, they just got to this part. Like, you know, he had walked through several times. Yeah. And I was thinking, if you did move it up, it wouldn't maybe have been as special.
Mm.
Because if you have too many
songs. Yeah.
Having worked on Glee, you know, sometimes less is more, you know, and I do think that those moments that them singing that, and then obviously the big one at the end for the Pope, really hit, because you weren't tired of seeing them sing.
I agree with that. I think if this movie was wall-to-wall music, to your point, it wouldn't seem as special. And I think also, in terms of the arc of the nuns that are singing and how seeing, what is her name? It's at the end.
Mary
Roberts.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
Mary Roberts solo at the end of the movie gives me goosebumps every time I watch it. And I know it's not her voice. I know that someone else, she's lip syncing, but still, it's just what Dolores has given Mary is just so special, to your point, that you would have had to stutter step that one or two times to have more songs, that it might not have worked. I absolutely agree with that. I also think that when she gets to the choir and there's the woman, the nun, and forgive me, Lazarus, Lady Lazarus, I believe is her name, is doing a terrible job running this choir, mm-hmm. and she kind of usurps her. They don't turn Lady Lazarus into a villain. They don't turn her into someone who's, you know, butthurt about it. In fact, she becomes her partner and she becomes even better for it. Again, this is kind of those nuances, those choices that were made by the numerous screenwriters that allowed this thing, I think, to really take flight. There's just easy choices that weren't made, which I appreciate.
The nuns are all really well differentiated, you know, and that adds, I think it's kind of hard to screw up fish out of water as long as you are not like denigrating a culture, which unfortunately a lot of time happens in those movies. Sure. But the ones that really go beyond are the ones that like take pains to make the various like characters, either in the old world or the new world, depending on where the fish is out of water relative to the audience, you know, make them feel real.
I agree. And I also feel like, you know, the director of this film, Emile Ardolino, I believe is how you say it. Forgive me, I'm butchering that. The director of Dirty Dancing directed this film. And I think that something that is not that certainly Ebert doesn't give him nearly enough credence for is casting. This movie is incredibly well cast. And that's so much of directing, is understanding personalities and all that kind of stuff. Mary Wickes, I believe, is the woman who plays Sister Mary Lazarus, is hilarious. Mm-hmm. She nails every line that she has. People are allowed to have faces in this movie too, where it's like you're allowed to have these, just they feel like real people. I think of some of her delivery, Mary's delivery as Mary Lazarus, "We can't leave this up to the feds," I think is incredible. she's just wonderful in it, and she's just got such a wonderful personality. And seeing that as a director, I think, is so important. I know that so much of direction, or at least what we think direction is having an eye, a visual flair, you know, whatever the case might be. And that's certainly important. But letting your players do what they do and being the coach that understands how all those players can is incredibly important. And I think he does a great job at that in this movie.
Obviously, like, I think the truly great directors have a really strong understanding of pacing and visuals and performance, like to return to Spielberg, he's really good at all three, you know, and so that's why he's one of the greats. But like, I think that as critics, as a former critic, I think that critics often overvalue visual and undervalue.
Yes.
Occasionally they'll be good with like pacing if the editing is especially noticeable, but they undervalue the degree to which a director who's really good at getting performances, like what that person can bring to a project. We talked about Mike Nichols earlier. I think he is an okay visual stylist. There are some beautiful shots in all of his movies, but what he's really good at is he's maybe the best actor's director who ever worked. And like, but he never quite got to the level as some of his peers. And like, obviously he made some duds, so that's, you know, he made a movie about spy dolphins, so like, let's see.
He did.
But like, I do think that critics often undervalue the ability of a director to get not just one great performance, but an ensemble of great performances that then all fit together. Like, that's hard. It's really hard.
Audiences underappreciate that, if I'm being completely honest. I feel like it's so I watched the most recent season of Project Greenlight, which I don't know if you guys have watched, but it's good TV and I highly recommend it, especially since we obviously work in this business.
So wait, is this recent? Is this a recent? Oh, I haven't seen it. I've seen every other.
It's a whole reboot that's Issa Rae and Camille Nanjiani are producing it. And it is interesting.
Is it where is it?
Does a woman actually get to Max. Direct? Sorry.
It's yes, on it's Max, a, the place for woman. HBO. Okay.
Yes. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I bring this up only to say that, you know, what's fascinating about that show as people that work in the industry is sort of the confluence of trying to make a good movie, but also making a good television show is in of itself impossible, right? Like the way to make a good television show is to inherently make a bad movie is kind mm-hmm. of the problem that the show ultimately struggles with. But I bring this up only to say that understanding how many things a director has to do, right? Like a director isn't just one thing. It isn't just, picking visuals, right? Like, actually directing actors, physically going up to people and giving them, you know, various directions as to how to elicit a performance is, I would argue, fundamental, and maybe 50% of the job is that, and yet it's a thing that we don't even think about.
I just want to add to that. I agree.
Yeah.
And especially in a comedy.
Oh yeah.
It's like, you have to have such a gentle hand because the characters cannot know they're in a comedy. The characters think they're in a drama. That's always like every moment is very important and real to them. And that's how, and I'm going to bring Barbie into this for 1 second because I saw it Friday and I loved it. And every Barbie can, you know, all the characters in that movie were not in a comedy. This was their lives and it mattered. And that's why it was funny because, you know, it was these situations. There was a few jokey jokes, which were amazing, but you know, that's always the key. No one's winking at the camera. You know, these are legitimate conflicts for these people. Well,
I'm glad you brought it up because I think it's worth. I wanted to get your obviously say so. You work primarily in comedy, I would say, and the disservice coming back to what you were saying, Emily, about critics and this idea that if comedy is done well, it feels effortless. So people don't realize how fucking hard it is to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So and also, I think that. We love to laugh as people, right?
I don't.
Emily doesn't. Emily's not a funny person. but I think that we take it for granted, right? Like the laughter and what that brings to us oddly feels less substantive, I put that in quotation marks, as a drama, right? And I think that we can all safely say that it's easier to make somebody cry than it is to make them laugh, because I think we all know the buttons of sentimentality or things that we know will elicit dramatic mm-hmm. emotion from people. Making people laugh is incredibly difficult, which is why I think this movie, you know, in his review, Ebert talks about how pedestrian the direction is. And it's like, if you're talking about fucking like camera angles or some shit, sure. But like having the know-how to let this play out and to see the jokes and to have that light a touch, I think in comedy is vitally important. I'm assuming you agree.
I 100% agree. And also coming up in film school, like there was this idea of, I can't remember if I learned it when I was studying cinematography or just, you know, general like film courses. There's this idea of not, I'm trying to remember which cinematographer or director it was, but it's like, he didn't want people to notice the shots because if you're noticing the shots, you are remembering that you're watching a movie, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why like, you know, sometimes I'll have like a shot where you're like inside a freezer and the character opens the door. Like you're very aware. Oh my God, they put the camera in the freezer. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I think again, there should be an effortlessness to it so that you just feel like you're there in the moment with these people. And I think it specifically helps for comedy because if you are constantly reminding people you're watching a movie, then you're just taken out of it.
you're not pulling them in. I mean, I saw Roger Deakins recently did a Q&A before Fargo that I saw at the Alamo a few months ago. And he said exactly that. Because someone asked, you know, what's your favorite, you know, cinematography or, you know, photographed film? And he's like, listen, the first time you watch a movie, if you're noticing the cinematography, it's failed, right? Like, if you're watching a movie multiple times, then you're seeing, you know, then you're mm-hmm. watching it to see all the different pieces. But yeah, if you're noticing the cinematography right off the bat, you're not fully immersed in the in the storytelling.
The other thing, sorry, that I just wanted to add about directing in general mm-hmm. was I recently went to see Into the Woods at the Amundsen, and I'd never seen the play. Mm-hmm. Did you see it?
I saw it on Friday.
Oh, okay. I saw it like the weekend before.
Yeah.
And I had seen the movie, and I really hated the movie, and I barely got through it. I think at where the act break of the play is, I think that's where I turned the movie off. And I went to the play, and Emily, I don't know how you felt, but I thought it was hysterical. Like, I laughed more in that play than I've ever laughed in a play, and in a musical, right? And I was thinking, well, sorry, maybe Book of Mormon, you know, but sure. I didn't go into it thinking this is a comedy. And I think the way the choices the director made, the choices the actors made, the staging of it, the cow was a puppet that had reactions. Like, there were huge, huge laughs in that theater that I was like, this is incredible. Like, I thought mm-hmm. it was incredible. And the people I'd seen it with had seen the play many times. And they were like, this is the best version we've seen of the play. And I have to say, that's the directing, right? Because it's the same play.
The thing about Into the Woods is the fact that it ends in such a serious place tricks people into thinking the whole story is very serious. But Act One is a comedy. It is just straight up. There's gag lines. Sondheim's lyrics are very playful. You know, there's a lot of room for interpretation for a director and a cast. But like, the idea is you should kind of play that. It's a fairy tale, so it should have a whimsical sense of comedy to it. But because the second act is a little bit more serious, a lot of people transpose that to everything. And I think Rob Marshall did that in the movie. Most of the productions I've seen of it have been bad. It was a show I didn't really like until I saw that Amundsen. I still think it's like, for me, it's one of the lower tier Sondheims, but like, that's also blasphemy. So, but I get why people love it now, because that first act, when it works, makes the second act work so much better. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, it's interesting because it's like then the tension occurs later, but you go into, you know, intermission kind of bubbly and joyful, even though you know something's coming, you don't really know what's coming. And then, yeah, again, because I hadn't watched the second half of the movie, I was like, oh shit, like things are dark. But then obviously that's part of what he's saying, you know, about fairy tales and careful what you wish for and all that. Again, I was just blown away by how little, there's like almost no sets, you know, it's just really actors acting.
The other thing that I think is worth noting as well is the musical components of this, of Sister Act, right? Of, you know, Stacey, obviously you worked on Glee, and Emily, I know you're a big musical fan. And I think that, this movie does something that great musicals do, which is break through and really kind of give you this sense of like anything is possible. Like, great musicals, you know, part of the problem I think that some people seem to have with musicals, I guess, is suspense of disbelief. Like, why are people just breaking into song? This movie obviously isn't doing that, because these are choir pieces and they make sense within the context of the movie. But this fusion that they're making between musicals and religion, this idea that songs mm-hmm. can bring you closer to God, if you will, or closer to some sort of other level of existence or whatever the case might be, is just really beautiful and really lovely. And you mentioned the My God, My Guy musical scene, which is just wonderful because it's so playful and it's cute and it's funny. But even the end, when they sing I Will Follow Him, is I mean, honestly, like, kind of getting goosebumps just thinking about it. And I'm not a religious person by any means, but this idea that, like, they found a way to marry these two things together, no pun intended, is really wonderful. Like, and it, that's the thing about the back half of this movie that made me see, like, this is the juice, and this is how I can understand why this movie, in concert with Whoopi, becomes a sensation. Mark Shaiman, who did the music for this, who's obviously, you know, a titan of industry, is part of that too.
It's also very smart about ending the story on that character stuff. It goes back to the choir and the church after resolving the mob stuff. And I think that that's also weird, mm-hmm. like overlap with Honeymoon in Vegas. A whole bunch of people get on a plane and force it to go to Nevada. Yeah. And honestly, it worked much better here.
It did. Also, yeah. There's no world where that many nuns get in that helicopter.
That was like, wild.
It was wild because, like, you see that they're all there's. I would argue there's probably 12 or 15 nuns when they try to kind of guilt this helicopter pilot into flying them to Nevada. Then you've got a medium shot of them looking through the window, and then a shot of post landing 15 nuns just running at, I'm just like, what is going on here,
buddy? Like a clown car. It's like called a nun helicopter. Yeah.
It should have been a small like one prop airplane, and then they all should have skydived out of it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and their habits just turned into wings.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want to go back 1 second to, yes, like the religion and music.
Yeah.
I took this course in college. It was like music appreciation, and we all took it thinking, you know, it's just an easy pass, but it was actually very difficult. And it started with the history of music, and the history written music began with Gregorian chants. It begins with religion. That's where music like started, well, at least
right.
Written
it's
music.
Hymns. Right. Yes. I mean, I think that that's which I think is, again, you know, a subtlety be damned. I do think that Shaiman is looking at these hymns and he's finding ways to fold them into gospel music, to fold them into rock and roll, to kind of find a way to the confluence of all these things working together. And he succeeds wonderfully. I mean, it right. All of these things are speaking to each other. It's part of why, and I'm glad that we don't actually have this in text, but it feels like it's part of why Reverend Mother, who's played by Maggie Smith, is ultimately taken with all of this. And eventually, obviously, she is our sort of antagonist, and then ultimately gets on board with Dolores's thing, is because I think she starts to see the power of these songs, right? Mm-hmm. It's and I mean, even the Pope sees it that way, I guess. But I just think that it's just interesting because, you know, you brought up Glee earlier, and I did a Patreon episode of the pilots of Glee and the pilot of Scream Queens. And when Glee was working, and Emily, you obviously spoke for you did many, many pieces on Glee, so you obviously know Glee quite well. When all those pieces are working and the planets align, there would be a musical sequence in Glee that was next tier, right? Like all of this, it's all working. It's all speaking to itself. The song is speaking to the relationships and all that kind of stuff. That show was just next level when all that stuff worked. Now, when it didn't work, it was less successful, we'll just say.
Right.
But I'm just,
I'd like to add that I think we also did that in Daisy Jones.
Absolutely, absolutely. But this is original music in Daisy Jones, correct?
As a musical.
Yeah.
So but it's, still, it's a musical. It's absolutely. Just, it's not breaking out into song, but we did, you know, talk a lot about
it's
diegetic, one thing,
I guess, is what I'm
Yeah,
at, right?
But one like thing that comes to mind is the, you know, Aurora, which was like the main song in the book. You know, we talked a lot about how to like plant the song so that it's, it becomes that the viewer starts to know the song, so that by the time you're playing the song at the end, it feels like, oh yeah, my favorite song,
sure.
without feeling like you're playing it every single episode and, you know, getting tired of it, but you had to play it enough that the audience, I don't know. There's just,
no, I know what you're saying. It's, you know, the flip side to that, which I think is also successful, is something like That Thing You Do, which is, right? That song is played what feels like a million times in that movie, and it always works.
Yes.
And you understand why it's this big hit, and it's ultimately kind of the nucleus or the beating heart of that movie. But that song needs to be perfect in order to do that.
Right.
And that's, you know, incredible.
I would also say that in a perfect, a great song or a great concert or musical event can feel otherworldly or godly.
Absolutely.
When done right. So it makes a lot of, you know, it makes sense to connect it to hymns. It does kind of take you out of your body in a way.
Well,
so.
It's, I mean, they're everyone at one point or another in their life has been alone in their car singing a song too loudly, and feeling as though they are connecting with that music in some way and that it's all kind of working. And I think that that's the power of music. It's why I think ultimately it's in Barbie as well. There are musical sequences in Barbie that are tremendous, that, you know, that the reverence towards those old school musicals. I keep waiting, and it feels like Hollywood keeps kind of fucking it up, but like, why the movie musical hasn't has not come back in a real way continues to surprise me. But Emily, you look to give something.
Everybody thought 2021 was going to do it, like In the Heights, which I love,
and
West Side Story. Like, people were like, these are going to be hits, and then they both flopped.
Yep.
And it does feel like, but it does feel like, you know, people are, I think you have to trick people into watching a musical. Like, the you know, Barbie, it is, does have musical numbers, but like, that's not, they're not really selling it on that. Like, you, once you see the trailer, you know, there's shots from it in there. But yeah, I have a friend coming. So,
Is it a little friend there?
Oh.
She's not feeling well, so we're not going to daycare today.
Margo's entered. Oh, sorry. We'll bleep
that's
out.
Okay.
A baby has entered the chat.
Oh, hi, baby.
Would you look at her? Oh my god, she loves a screen.
When you said the thing about singing in your car too loudly, I've only done that one time.
Only once?
It was Smash Mouth's All Star, and a car of some other kids pulled up right alongside me. I was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, sitting at a stoplight, singing All Star really loudly and dancing. And a car pulled up next to me, and they all looked at me and they laughed. And I've never done it since.
Aww.
I've done it many times, innumerable times, but the one time that has always stayed with me is, back in high school, I went to pick up my friends, and so I pulled up to the house, and the window was down, and I was singing a song very loudly, but you couldn't hear the music. You could only hear me. And they literally walked out of the house and looked at me, and they were just horrified. And it's just a thing that I'll remember to this day of like, just always roll your windows up. Don't ever have your windows down singing loudly is ultimately my takeaway from that. But this is,
I just want to add add with the musicals, when I was watching Barbie, I'm like, this is going to be an amazing Broadway musical. I think they're going to do it.
Sure.
And In the Heights and, you know, West Side Story, I think we should be able to make a movie musical that wasn't a play. It's a totally different thing. Just start with the thing that it is. Build it as a movie musical. Don't try to adapt.
Well, that's what Moulin Rouge was. I mean, ultimately.
Yes.
I mean,
and I love that.
I think that movie is successful at doing sort of what we're talking about metatextually and all the things. But I also think, I mean, listen, I think part of the reason that In the Heights and West Side Story didn't do as well is they came out in a year where people still weren't feeling comfortable going to the movies. But even if they were, I don't think those movies would have been hugely successful either way. But I do think that ultimately what this movie does really well is we really only have like three songs. I mean, ultimately, you've got the opening with them in Nevada. You've got My God, and you've got I Will Follow Him. Those are basically the only, I mean, I'm sure
it's kind of cabaret, honestly.
Is it right? I mean,
is sort of like the musical numbers are diegetic. They are filmed in a different location, and like they are used to comment on the action. Thinking about this, it is interesting that the movie musicals that are built from the ground up that tend to be successful are musicals that use other music people are familiar with. Like Singing in the Rain is that. They just took a bunch of songs people knew. And the movie and then the ones that have original music are like adaptations of Broadway. And the best ones, I think, find a melding of both or heavily rework their source material in some way. But like, it is very weird that we seem incapable of creating a successful movie musical with original songs that is not a stage adaptation.
I don't get it. I'm looking at the soundtrack for Sister Act 1 right now. Obviously there's I Will Follow Him, Dolores and the Sisters, there's Shout, which I don't believe. Oh, that's what's singing over the credits. Is their rendition of Shout. I do love that there is only one original artist or that I'm seeing on the soundtrack, which is CNC Music Factory, are on this soundtrack.
That's for the montage when they're cleaning everything.
Just a Touch of Love is the is them. Yeah, so it is interesting. There's not a ton of music in this movie, and yet it's still kind of a musical. I mean, would it fall under a musical?
I mean, the sequel is on some list of the best movie musicals ever made. Okay, and like its music is even more heavily confined to like a specific part of its running time.
It's kind of a Glee thing too, right? Yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah. It's like these movies feel the need to like spend an hour being like, here's how Whoopi got into this predicament. Now we're going to have songs. And they should just be like, she has to be a nun again. Yeah, now we're going to sing. Yeah. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
So let's rate this movie, shall we? Emily?
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw this in 1992, I quite liked it. I probably would have given it like a 65. I don't know that I loved it, but like I definitely saw it. I mean, I certainly watched it a bunch of times. I'm up to like a 75 now. I think this movie is like really solid. And after the conversation, I might even go to like a 77 or a 78. Like I think that this movie, when it's working, it's really working. And even if I might have some issues with like the first half hour to 45 minutes, I think that the back hour is just so good. And I Will Follow Him rips. I think we should all be listening to that on a regular basis. So that's where I'm at. But how about you, Emily? Where are you?
Well, when I saw this in the theaters in 1992, I would have given it a 97. Now, at the time, I gave all movies a 99 or a 0, but this movie didn't have her get saved at the end. So you got to take 2 points off for that.
Yeah. For God.
Watching it yesterday, I was like, this movie holds up well. It certainly has some of the problems that, you know, it starts slow. I do think the anonymous direction hurts it a bit, especially in the musical numbers. But it, you know, the music's fun. Whoopi's great. The cast is terrific. I'm going to go 70, just a straight up 70. That's 3.5 out of 5 stars. That feels right to me.
I want to say that I do love that punctuing your ratings is your daughter's tiny hand coming into frame to pull your hair.
Yeah.
She has a rating too.
What do you think? What's your rating?
Grabbing the mic.
Yeah.
You're a born podcaster.
So, Stacey, what did you think in... obviously, you didn't see this in
92. I didn't see it, so I don't have a number from there.
So what's your pre-podcast number?
Pre-podcast, I think I'm going to say 70.
Okay.
And post, I'm going to say 75. I think I went up just because, sometimes I try to look for problems and I don't think there were that many problems. I thought it was kind of a delightful, just goes down easy. You know, I can see why it's not even a guilty pleasure. It's just like a pleasure. I can see it's the type of movie that if it were on, you would just go, oh, hey, this is on. I'm going to keep watching it. Like, it's kind of how I feel about like Tropic Thunder or Zoolander. Certain movies I'll just like, oh yeah, I can watch this. I can just get into this.
You know, I think it's interesting because first of all, I agree. And I do think that, and Emily, I think we've discovered this in our covering of comedies from 92 of just sort of the standards were different. Audiences weren't as jaded. You were kind of given a little bit more rope and a little bit more leeway. And I think that if you made this movie today, I think people might be put it under a microscope a little bit more in terms of some of the turns of story. But, you know, it works partially because it's Whoopi, partially because it's 92. The concept is just fun and you kind of go with it. I think today it would almost have to be like more heightened. Like, I almost feel like it would probably be like a Will Ferrell comedy or something like that today. In some
Will Ferrell should play a nun. That sounds great. I think if this movie were made today, it would just be a ton of discourse around the fact that the Catholic Church covered up, you know, child sexual abuse for decades. And like, I think that would be a totally fair line of reasoning. Like, that's part of the problem with making these sorts of comedies now is like, yeah, we're just so much more cognizant of A, the rest of the world, and B, the ways the rest of the world is terrible. So
no, for sure. I do, you know, the musical thing is interesting as well, because Emily, we're going to record an episode next week on
Extra. Read all about it.
and which is kind of one of the only big, I mean, I guess Aladdin's technically a musical. I mean, it is a musical, mm-hmm. but Newsies was just a big swing and a whiff back in the day. Didn't make any money, was a big bomb, and has subsequently has a whole cult following now, and a musical was made on Broadway.
Not to spoil my take, I don't think it's a very good musical. I don't think it works. So
I look forward to talking about it. More than anything, have you seen Newsies, Stacey?
No. I've made many a newsy joke in a script.
Sure.
Usually based on wardrobe, you know.
Sure.
It's an easy one, but I've actually never seen it. No.
You know, Emily, not to burn any takes before we talk about it on mic, but I'll just say that I think that, and we'll sort of unpack this in bigger scale when we have Dana Schwartz on to talk about it. But I do think that as a musical, like in terms of the format of a musical, I would agree with you. But I also think that there are some songs in it that absolutely rip that I love.
That's my big problem. Could not hum. I've watched that movie three times now. I could not tell you what any of the songs are.
There are some songs that I think are absolutely amazing, that I absolutely love. And part of it is because I had the soundtrack as a kid. So like, I just, there's all that being said. Yeah.
The first time I watched it was 2020. So I'm sure this is
if the songs don't work for you, it doesn't work, which comes back to sort of our original point, I think, a little bit, which is that like the greatest musicals, the songs have to be incredible. Like, they have to be amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of why Sister Act works is because I think we give a lot of rope to musicals, like to the rules of existing inside a musical movie. And I think that this movie is kind of adhering to that as well.
Yeah.
So I
had some problems with Barbie, a movie I really like, but I think has issues. But like, when they started doing musical numbers, I was like, yeah, this is great. We're just going to do this. This sounds perfect.
I think I adored Barbie. I think it's absolutely wonderful. I think that it is trying to do a lot of things. Yeah. So I think that, you know, if they all work for you is obviously just, you know, that's a. Oh, she's got thoughts.
She has thoughts on Barbie.
What did you think about Barbie?
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
Hello.
That's a perfect way to wrap up this episode. Stacey,
yes.
Thank you so, so much for coming on to talk about Sister Act with us. And
you're welcome.
The great thing is that even if you're moving to a new city, I can still force you to get on Zoom and talk with us about movies. So,
that is correct.
I
look forward to being a judge at the film festival in Bend.
Yes, exactly.
Listen, I want to get on
not
that
over
list.
My dead body.
Why can't we both do it? Is there only one judge?
No, there's so many judges. So we could both do it.
I could just sneak in. They won't even know.
It's gonna be perfect. So thank you so much, Stacey, for coming out to talk with us about
anytime.
This. And I look forward to talking about many other things in the future with you. So.
Yes, me too.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Podcast Nuggets. Podcast Nuggets. 1992. 1992. Podcast Nuggets.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.